Welcome to podcast number 6.
Hello.
You kicked the microphone stand again.
I did again. It's just what I do. I just kick mic stands. But it didn't. It wasn't audible last time, and it won't be audible this time. So yet another intro where we waste 10 seconds on nothing. Hello.
What are we going to talk about?
We're going to talk about the internet.
Which is probably a good thing to talk about, actually, given that the whole point of New Music Strategies is that there's an internet.
There's an internet, and it's a force for good. I wrote a blog post saying the internet fundamentally a force for good once, and it is. But one of the conversations that happens amongst musicians a lot.
But before we get onto that, that's something we're going to have to come back to, because I think that's something that you can debate. I think that the fact that the internet can be used as a force for good is certainly there, but the technology itself is not.
No, it's neutral.
It's neutral, yeah. In the same way that, you know, mind you, this comes back to, you know, guns don't kill people, people do, but people with guns are more likely to kill people than people with, you know, meringues.
Yeah, quite, yes, yes. If you've got, yes, as it is.
So it's only to a point it's neutral.
So guns don't kill people, people do, but they help.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But I think communications technology in general is a good thing. I think that people can use it for ill. It's not like nuclear power where inherent in all of it is the potential for damage, because even if you build a power plant that's about making power, they can still melt down and kill people.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And actually, having a conversation about music is unlikely to lead to death. I don't know.
Usually. But I think the interesting thing about it is that it is a way of communicating with each other. People kind of fetishize, I think, this idea that the internet has all this agency, like websites make us do certain things, and you know, technologies make us more social, less social, you know, and the idea that this inanimate object, which is actually just a network of computers, can make us do anything is absurd. But what it does is it opens up potentials for us to use them in certain ways.
I think actually the controlling part is the way that we describe it. Actually, the language around the internet is far more has far more of a kind of social engineering agenda than the mechanism of the internet. So we talk about, we describe things as being, I don't know, a term like social networking, that within that there's social element and networking element, both of which aren't inherent to the technology. They're about a way of perceiving what we're doing with that.
Yeah. And technologies are always, the uses of them are always socially negotiated. The internet is the way that it is because we decided that that's how it should be used.
As an aside, before we get to our main point, this is going to be another long one, isn't it? I don't know if we have a point, probably not. We never really have a point, do we? But I was once involved in a conversation about a multi-billion euro European project to remake the internet. This was the most ridiculous conversation I think I've ever been a part of, but it was hosted by a university that I was doing some work with, and so I was co-opted in to be on a panel about mobile stuff and how mobile sort of was helping entrepreneurs. But at the beginning, this guy did this whole presentation about what they were going to do to the internet with these billions of pounds. And I said, hold on a minute. You haven't mentioned social science in this at all. You haven't talked about anthropologists or sociologists or any kind of anyone talking about how people use things and what's good. Where are they in this debate? Because you sound like an economist. And he said, "Oh well, we haven't really included them. They were not really in our remit." I said, "How can they not be in your remit? You're talking about the internet.
You're talking about human beings talking to each other."
And the beautiful thing was that the next woman to get up onto her panel got up and said, "Hello, I'm head of the Department of Anthropology at Oxford or something." And oh, thank God! So they are going to be in it. And she kind of proceeded to say what you know needed to be said, which was that you can't do this kind of thing from a pure technology point of view. But anyway, the conversation that I was going to kick off at the start was that musicians often talk about the new MySpace, because musicians had this idea that MySpace was the be all and end all of what musicians were meant to do on the internet. That yeah. it they looked at it and they went, oh look, I can post music and I can post pictures and I can have a bio and it can be act as a sort of press kit and that's all I need. And so as much as MySpace got musicians talking, it also provided an enormous disservice by presenting a set of very limited and narrow assumptions about what it was that musicians were meant to do with the internet as it relates to their music.
Well, I always had a criticism of MySpace, apart from all the, they can put ads that you've got no control over on your, you know, presentation, yeah, et cetera, et cetera. But that it was approached, and this is why it was bought by News Corp, it was approached as broadcasting. That the way the broadcasting works, particularly commercial broadcasting, is the product is not the music. The product is the audience.
Mm.
And the customer is the advertiser.
Yeah.
So it's a way of gathering up a large group of people and selling them en masse to a bunch of advertisers. That's how commercial broadcasting works. And that's how MySpace was trying to work. But it fundamentally understood that this was not a broadcast medium. It was a conversational medium. So, but what it was trying to do was turn those conversations into an audience. And that kind of broke what made MySpace kind of potentially really great, and essentially made it this thing where even U2 had, you know, ads for suspiciously cheap clothing on their website. Yeah. It's kind of this band, yeah, that's, yeah, renowned for sort of having an opinion about that sort of stuff. And so the kind of the commercial imperatives of large-scale mass broadcasting just trumped and overruled everything that made MySpace potentially meaningful, particularly for independent music.
Yeah. And I think that there also was a sort of portent of the way to come, in that they didn't offer a pro account. So in the same way that both Twitter and Facebook have avoided allowing us to buy ourselves out of the adosphere,
mm,
that we're stuck in this place where...
Which is nonsense.
It's horrendous. I mean, we've been told what a Facebook account is worth. It's $150 a year is what each user is worth to them. Yeah. So we go, well, great. Well, why can't we pay $150 and get out? Why can't we pay $10 a month, $11 a month, and opt out? Because that's what you've told us it's worth. So let us pay that.
I'll pay mine, yeah.
Yeah, I'll pay mine, and you can stay the hell out of my space.
Yeah.
My space. So I guess, in a sense, the question of what's the new MySpace? Well, the new MySpace is Facebook, but the problem with that is that MySpace broke for a reason, and Facebook are doing all the same things, which is... that what they want is page impressions. The thing they've added on top of that MySpace never did, as far as I know, is the data harvesting side of it.
Mm.
But that wasn't the point. We will get onto a look at Facebook.
Well, before we do, I just sort of wanted to backtrack one point, which is this thing about socially negotiated spaces, because technologies are what we use them for.
Mm.
The telephone started as an entertainment system where you picked up the party line at 7 o'clock in the evening. You could hear the concert at the town hall down the end of your street. Radio started as point-to-point communication, ship to shore. But we decided as a society, and for economic reasons and for cultural reasons, that's not what we wanted to use those technologies for. Now radio is the entertainment medium that is kind of centrally based and spreads out to a broadcast network, and telephone is for point-to-point communication. And so the technology opens up what I call, and what other people call before me, affordances. This is what you can do with this technology. This is what this enables, but that doesn't make you do anything. You can choose, you know, a room has affordances. I could go and stand on that table if I want to, because that allows me to do that. If there was no table there, there would be no standing to be done. But that doesn't mean that that's how I have to particularly use that piece of technology. So... I do want to kind of wave a flag for, we get to decide this as a culture, as a society, what we want to use our technologies for. But unfortunately, there are not evenly distributed power relationships in that. So there are people who have, like for instance, Facebook, who have large amounts of capital wrapped up in certain types of control.
Mm.
And, you know, we have limited agency within that. So it's not the technology, it's still human beings doing things. Well, and it's worth waving a flag about that.
No, it's absolutely, and I guess the contrast is ontology and utility.
Mm.
Is what are you actually doing? Well, you're sharing bytes, you're sharing data, digitized data, which can be, you know, of any screen shareable or speaker shareable form. So it could be pictures, it can be text, it can be whatever, and it can be shared in any way, and it can be hosted in any way, and it can then be filtered in any way and combined in any way.
Yeah,
that's the kind of the extant reality of what the internet makes possible. The utility is the way that we use it as one-to-one, one-to-many, or one-and-many communication tools, and that I think it was Toby Moores from Sleepy Dog who was first made the distinction with Twitter of it being about not one too many, but one and many. That it's a series of group conversations. That actually it wasn't that the distinction from broadcast, that it wasn't binary, and that it wasn't me just talking to you, but it was me talking with you and with lots of other people at the same time.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. When I guess Twitter was kind of nascent, I used to talk about it as a performance conversation. That you and I could have a conversation with each other,
yeah,
but to other people, it's as if we're on a stage.
Yeah, and I can't. What the thing I like about that is I like the way that it makes people up their game in terms of the creative use of language. That people become very conscious of the fact that they need to rise above the mundane in order to do that, and that manifests itself partly as kind of insane exhibitionism when people say stupid stuff and post ridiculous pictures and whatnot. But it also
trolling, you know.
Yeah, but it also means that you and I think for 30 seconds before we structure a tweet, because we think, well, I have 140 characters, I want to say this in a way that is interesting, and we neologize in interesting ways because we've learned through a million words of usage that actually those kind of things can make it fun and that we get playful with it. But I think that and for me that experimental space is one of the utilities of the web that I find most interesting, because it is both moment to moment. It's free. You've paid for the service, and once you've paid for the service, you can do what you want with it. Mm. So anything you add to it reduces the cost of it, of the sort of unit cost of internet things. But also, it's that a lot of that usage is ephemeral. So I can experiment with music or with artwork or with conversation or with text or with whatever on. Many, many levels. I could create a pseudonym if I suddenly decided that I wanted to be a poet. I wouldn't have to go, this is now Steve Lawson musician becoming Steve Lawson poet. I could go and post it somewhere that no one could see, or I could share it with a small community, and it affords me a space in which to expand my creative sense of self in a way that costs me nothing, but in which I can granularize access.
Well, from a psychological perspective, there's a really interesting angle to the way that we use language in a performative context, which is to say that if I have a conversation with you, I use certain language. If I have a conversation with my grandmother, I'll use different language. Yeah. If I'm having a conversation with a guy down the road at the corner shop, I'll use... People just naturally use the context to shape the way in which they communicate. Now, people have started to figure out what the context is for something like Twitter. And so there are ways of talking that are emerging, I think, which are very much about performance, that you get on Twitter, that are people kind of... They tell certain types of jokes that have a particular kind of format to them and those sorts of things. And we kind of naturally understand the environment within which we're communicating. And I think that's really interesting. But I kind of... doesn't answer the question, which we really sort of pressed record to talk about, which is, okay, so what should musicians do on the internet as a result of that?
I think the first point is that the feature set as defined by MySpace was useful in terms of defining what's, you know, the sort of broad thing of image, audio, text. But because it kind of mulched it all into one page and turned it into a broadcast press release, actually missed the nuance and beauty in all three, and also the way that you can use all three in many different ways. And so let's contrast Bandcamp and SoundCloud.
Okay.
Because Bandcamp is a music sales and distribution platform. It allows you to stream things in full. There's no kind of limited stream. You go, thank God. There's no 30-second iTunes style. Yeah. You know. There's no way of trying
barely to... barely long enough to recognize a piece of music, let alone get to like it.
The when Ethan built Bandcamp, he recognized that actually the idea of teaser content only worked if you were already, you know, you already had millions of people wanting to hear what you were doing.
Or it only worked in the sense that you tease a dog. Yeah. It's just annoying.
Well, I think if you're Michael Jackson, and this is where musicians get the idea from. If Michael Jackson had a new record out, if he hadn't made anything for 5 or 6 years, and you know, so when Dangerous came out, the fact that there was going to be an advert on that contained 30 seconds of that music was an issue because people were like, well, what's he going to sound like? This is the thing.
Mm.
And but it's predicated on the idea that there is an audience of any size that are actually waiting to hear what you've said, and that your pre-existing audience is the most important one to connect with. And Ethan very, very smartly realised after reading your book that actually for most musicians that's balls. That's not the case. That actually for me, my existing audience is one I'm incredibly grateful for and I'm beholden to, in the sense that they've taken the time to find me and to listen to me and to interact with me in some way. But that in putting music online, this is the notion that my most important purpose is to tease them into being interested in what I'm doing. It's just insane. I mean, you know, that's nuts. That actually what I want is to give them the possibility of sharing it and doing the promo side of it for me, to get excited about it, to fall in love with it, and to say to their friends, this is great. So,
and also hopefully to kind of download it, maybe buy it. Yeah.
So the beauty of Bandcamp is that it's formatted around things being presented in a way that look finished. It doesn't. There is no distinction on Bandcamp between work in progress and finished product. So to put them both alongside one another in the same format would actually be quite confusing. So I tend to use Bandcamp for finished product. It might be a developing product. It might be that I've got one track that's finished and I add to it.
Yeah.
So when Lo and I released Life So Far, the reason it's called Life So Far is that as we went on the tour, it's like, well, this is what we've done so far. And we put up the tracks as I mixed and mastered them on tour. We'd record them. I'd listen back to the gig the next day and go, well, that's good. Mix that particular take and upload it. And we ended up with 10 tracks of stuff that we were really, really pleased with. But each one, none of them were demos. They were all finished product. It was just that the collection grew. SoundCloud, when you upload something to SoundCloud, it gives you, there is this lovely drop-down box, tag box. The primary distinction is, what is this? Is it stems? Is it a mashup? Is it a work in progress? Is it a demo? Is it a live recording? You can actually say, this is finished or this isn't.
Yeah, and this is what this particular piece of music means as a work.
Yeah, I mean, you can even, and obviously that because it's a sound platform rather than a music platform, putting up a conversation like this would be absolutely fine. We could do that. We could stick, you can use it for podcast, you can use it for radio, you can use it for whatever. That it's a much more kind of, in terms of the utility versus the ontology. The ontology is the same. It's just, it's still a way of hosting audio on the web that means that your piece of audio has a URL that you can share around. But in terms of the utility, it's laid out in a very different way, and that the guidance within the upload process is very much about, this is just audio. No, you need to tell us what it's meant to be.
Well, the main atomic unit of Bandcamp is the album, and the main atomic unit of SoundCloud is the track.
Yeah.
And a track may or may not be part of an album. And you can, with Bandcamp, you can break it down into songs. But the kind of the main thing that you're presented with, both as somebody who's using the service and somebody who's sort of approaching it as a consumer, you're presented with albums.
Yeah.
And so there is that kind of different, I guess, narrative structure to it as well.
Curatorial side.
Yeah. I mean, it's the difference between paintings and exhibitions. Bandcamp is where the exhibitions are held. SoundCloud is, you know, here is my latest painting.
Yeah. Or my latest photo or my latest whatever. That actually it's the suggestion that there's nothing pejorative within the SoundCloud setup between putting up a recording that is, here's a 3-second sample of a fart that you can use for Foley work, versus here's 3 hours of me talking to my grandparents because it's an archive of a conversation with someone from the war years. That none of that, there's no sense in which one of those is an acceptable use.
It comes down to social objects. The social object on SoundCloud is the song or the track. The social object on Bandcamp is the album. If I was to embed something of yours and I wanted to embed an album, I would probably be more likely to embed a Bandcamp than a collection of SoundCloud links, even though that's possible. It makes more sense to me as a social object. Bandcamp has, as a social object, primarily albums, and SoundCloud primarily tracks.
Yeah, and the collection process on SoundCloud is quite different as well. And I tend to use SoundCloud for works in progress for power release work. So things that are come in between releases. So bits of live stuff that is interesting, that is possibly going to be up for release. So the first two tunes off of 11 Reasons were Travelling North and Nothing Can Prepare. And both of them were recorded at home by surprise. We were surrounded by boxes, we were moving house. And I thought, oh, I need to have a play about this. I need to kind of sit in the middle of all these boxes and think about moving and think about having a 1-year-old and all that kind of stuff. And I played these two tunes and my immediate response was, I'm going to stick these on SoundCloud because I want people to hear them. It wasn't, I need to do artwork and I need to present them in a format that I can sell them. It was, I need to get these to a form where I can, they're uploadable and stick them on SoundCloud. And that in turn built an audience for the record because they had, I don't know, 1,000 listeners. And there were quite a few listens, the two of them.
Well, just to put it in music business speak, SoundCloud's a good way to do promo.
It's a really good promo platform. And so I was able to put those up and people went, oh, this is great. When can I get this?
Yeah.
So I generated a whole lot of buzz. And it meant that when I then was able to put them on Bandcamp, that the SoundCloud had done the donkey work for me. And so people went in and they knew, there were three of the tunes off that record that they already knew. There were those two and there was the one, the opening tune, A Year Afloat, which had been on YouTube for a year and a half, a version of it, the first version of it. And I was able to stick that up. And so there are a number of different audio platforms online. There were those two. For this podcast, we use archive.org because the parameters mean that there's no limit, that we can assign the license in a certain way. It doesn't cost us anything, but we become part of the archive of the internet, which is just kind of nice. I kind of like the thing of that. But so in terms of the toolkit, I find both Bandcamp and SoundCloud, because they're both shareable beyond their own site, neither of them are a destination. Mm-hmm. Both of them are a conduit. And so for me, everything needs to be a conduit. I don't like destinations.
Or that they have the possibility of being conduits. Because to be fair, Bandcamp is becoming more of a destination. The discoverinator, in inverted commas, as a way of, I'm going shopping on Bandcamp. That's happening more and more.
But
you don't browse SoundCloud, for instance.
Well, I don't know. I think people do browse tags. I think that there are communities that form. I think that there are communities, because there are groups on SoundCloud as well.
Right, of course.
But I think that both of them, one of the main impetuses with it is, can I share this thing?
Mm.
And both of them allow you to share share a track or share an album or share a set or share a tag or share a group. Everything is built around being bigger than the site itself,
yep,
in a way that MySpace never was.
It's what people call open web.
Yeah, absolutely. That it's that you can, it means that you can granularize things. Both of them are embeddable. I remember the clever hacks that people were coming up with to be able to embed their MySpace player on their own site. And there were people who wrote little bits of JavaScript that would scrape it. And I remember all the way through my time online, I've had a kind of team of amazing nerds who were happy to be paid in curry to help me out. And one of them, a friend of mine called James, who now works on the Gov.UK project, is an absolutely brilliant code nerd. And he was writing, he kept writing these bits of stuff that would scrape gig dates from MySpace and put them on your website and turning MySpace, which was wanting to be a destination, into a conduit. And every time he did, they went and changed the code. And they would kind of stop even doing, they were like, no, this is too good. We're being too useful. We must screw it up.
Yeah.
And both Bandcamp and SoundCloud for audio allow you to do that.
To be fair, the one thing that MySpace did contribute, I think, is the idea of the profile. And the idea of a centralized profile, this place where you could put your music, your photo, your conversation with fans, such as it was, there was this sort of one-pager that really, before MySpace, hadn't really kind of seeded in. People had tried it, but you had to have a MySpace page, you had to have a profile, and that was kind of the industry standard for this is how you present your work, and that's seeded a whole lot of ideas in other formats.
Well, this has kind of jumped to the end of the conversation, which is that actually when people say what's the new MySpace, the part of the sad thing is that nothing is yet, and that what we haven't built is we haven't built a version of MySpace that works, because MySpace was a great idea that didn't work. And
so I'm not sure that's the case.
I think there is a version of it that allows us to aggregate all of these things from conduits in a way that is searchable. And I think that because if we compare MySpace pages to Facebook artist pages, which I think have for the most part been a spectacular failure.
I hope so.
because they keep changing the design, so there's no uniformity of experience. So everything that Facebook is meant to bring, which is that simplicity of interface, when it comes to pages, they mess up every time because it's not built around making life easy for musicians, because they won't let you pay for a sensible experience. What they do is
they will let you pay for letting people see your updates.
God, I don't want to get into just how horrible that is and pernicious that is, but they still have two things. One of which is data scraping. The other is selling advertising, and that's what they do.
Yeah,
they sell information.
But it is a completely closed environment. You have to be in the Facebook environment.
It's
in order
absolutely
to do
a destination. So this is why. I would, contrasting Bandcamp and SoundCloud, both of which can be shared into Facebook, with putting music on Facebook, which can't then be shared out, certainly can't easily be shared out. And the same is true of photos, that if you put a photo on Instagram or Flickr, particularly Flickr, I mean, Flickr is now coming back into its own. God knows what happened when Yahoo bought it. They went, should we wait 3 years before we do anything good with it? Yeah, let's just be rubbish for 3 years. They kind of mothballed it, and all of a sudden, they've built an Android app that is by far the nicest photo app. But all along, the beauty of Flickr is that it's always been shareable, embeddable.
Yep.
It's very easy to like things on there. It's easy to have a conversation around photos. And that conversation has slowed down a lot in the last 2 or 3 years. But because they're in the business of photos, because they let you buy an account and then leave you the hell alone, that actually, I mean, the Flickr model or the Bandcamp model, I suppose, are those are the two. That SoundCloud has gone the Flickr model. They let you pay for an account, which means you can have big, big uploads and do all your stuff, and there's no advertising, there's no clumsiness. You either have a limited free account, or once you hit that limit, you go, okay, I need more space, so you pay for it. There's that, or there's the Bandcamp model, which is they let you make money and they take a cut. And Bandcamp don't make money unless we do.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about it, that Bandcamp haven't gone, oh, let's sell all-you-can-eat accounts to listeners. So if you can join Bandcamp and then for $10 a month you can download all the music you want. No, there's none of that at all. They've done it so that unless artists do well, it's impossible for them to exploit artists. There's no mechanism within it for them to win and us to lose. For them to win, we need to win even more.
Yeah, yeah.
So those are your two models. The model is pay us and we'll leave you alone, and or make money, and we'll make money off the back of that. And so therefore, we will keep making better money.
Okay, but here's where we kind of differ a little bit, because I don't think the idea, while it would be nice to have a really easy, centralized, one place, one page, and lots of people have done this kind of thing to do, this is the way you do a one pager, or this is the way you do it. The one sheet was a really good example of this.
Yeah.
And this is how you do it. What I really struggle with is that I really want people to own their own internet, to own their own domain, to have their own servers, to put their own stuff on it. And it needn't be a complex thing. It can be a shared thing. There are lots of easy ways to do this. But the idea that you own your own data, that when you upload photos to Facebook, they're not your photos anymore. They're Facebook's photos.
And now Instagram
because they bought Instagram. And I kind of struggle with this idea that we've got an entire kind of wave of people who go, well, I'll just put it on Facebook because that's how I share it, but without thinking of essentially ultimately who owns that stuff. And so rather than having this one centralized, ultimately commercial endeavor, which is about come and share it with me, which ultimately ends up being MySpace and Facebook, I think that the better thing to do is to have it be distributed. And that the format should be, this is how you do this, rather than come and let us do it for you.
No, we're totally in agreement. Because when I say that I think MySpace got it wrong, one of the things I got it wrong was centralization. That actually I think that what is useful is findability and a mechanism for grouping. And I don't think that requires you to... That one of the things, the nice things that MySpace did, but they did it in a way that was more useful as spam than it was as community was the friends, the visible friending thing.
Yeah.
And what the two things I got wrong. One of which was this idea that for you and I to be friends, either of us could invite them, but once it had happened, it appeared on both of ours as an extra point. So if I wanted to collect points, all I needed to do was go around and friend people, and if everybody else was collecting them, accepting them because they wanted to look like they had more points, that the person who was willing to click the most buttons wins,
yeah.
Which is insane.
Yeah.
So one of the beautiful things that Twitter has done is that it's completely undermined that. In the same way that if you compare...
It's made it asynchronous. Yeah. You can follow me without me following you.
Yeah. It's Facebook pages do the same thing. That it's very interesting to compare Facebook pages and profiles. And there are Facebook people I know with a Facebook profile with 5,000 friends on it, and a page with less than 100.
Right.
So none of those people on the profile have gone across and gone, I like this enough to click on here in order to kind of express that on another level.
Yeah.
And I find that kind of interesting. I mean, there are many reasons for that, but the most obvious one is that the person's actually gone around and friended everybody.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
this is one of the problems with centralization. Is that centralization leads to gaming? But one of the nice things was that there was a mechanism for saying these are the people I'm connected to. For Bandcamp have done it beautifully with the recommended albums thing.
Right.
Yeah. I really like that.
This is how you contextualize me more than that. You should. I mean, there is that kind of you should check out the stuff.
Mm.
But also the subtext of that is, here is how to make sense of me.
Yeah. This is my DNA. These are the things that, yeah. And it's funny the way that I remember having this conversation with, I think it was David Torn, the guitar player that we were talking about the people I'd sent CDs to, because I'd sent out a bunch of copies of a record of mine, and I'd sent the various people and I was mentioned it to him. And he went, you know, you maybe ought to be careful with that, because if they don't like it and they tell you, it might, you know, that could dent your confidence. I said, no. I said, whether they like it or not, you'll find it funny already.
Yeah.
And I said, no, because whether they like it or not tells me more about them than it does about me. Because I already know what I do well. I already know what I'm good at. I didn't need affirmation.
This is what I meant. This is why I thought that was funny, the idea that your confidence would be dented.
But I didn't need affirmation. What I was looking for was like minds to with whom to kind of connect, and so that it wasn't that I went to them and said, "Please tell me it's good, because then I'll feel like it's good."
Well, this is one weird thing, and I think we mentioned this on the podcast about reviews. Is when people send you a CD and go, "Tell me what you think," not even expecting a review, just tell me what you think. It's like, are you going to change the CD because of what I say? Why is this? You know, and it is a really kind of weird expectation that you're going to critique it. And say, well, I don't like this about it, and I do like this about it, and then there's a use for that.
And this, as though there's some kind of meaningful context for it. So the grouping thing, what the place where it's useful, and I don't have an answer to this. I haven't actually considered this, but the idea that actually there is some mechanism for connecting, because if you remember back to the web in the late 90s, there used to be web rings.
Yeah,
you would be
yeah.
part of a ring, and at the bottom of your page there would be a link, and you would say, click to the next person in this ring. And it was a very, very...
Wow, that's GeoCities territory.
Yeah, it was, absolutely. But the idea was that it was part of that desire for our sites to become a space that led you to somewhere else. That actually, that both in terms of what I could get from it, that, you know, that I would be led to by someone else.
Right.
But also that I could be a conduit to someone else. And so you could come into me and go, now you want to read about more people who are into Dungeons and Dragons. Here you go, click on this site.
So it's not about centralization; it's about obvious networking.
It's the Venn diagram of the internet. And when the Venn diagram of the internet looks like bubble wrap, it doesn't work. When it looks like a room full of beach balls, where it's kind of, you know, they're bigger, and when you look at them, they're overlapping, and they're kind of. Those are two very bad analogies. I don't know what frog's born, maybe. What I don't want is a flat thing where there's lots and lots of isolated circles that might touch don't do anything. What I want is a three-dimensional thing where they're all overlapping and connected and mushed up together, like semolina. I like that. And I remember a conversation with...
I'm going to have a completely different picture in my head when people say social glue now.
Yeah, you wouldn't see semolina. When I... I remember having a conversation with a musician a couple of years ago who had said, who had been looking at our website and said, oh, you shouldn't have a links page. It's really bad for SEO. The idea that somehow I was giving away web power to someone else by linking to them. And it you know, very in a very small way broke my heart, because I was like, really? You're more concerned about your Google rank than you are about connecting to people who are doing good things? That linking to people is a bad thing? And I thought about this when, because I occasionally get these emails from people saying, oh, can I stick an advert on your site? I just want to put a link on an old page and I'll pay you 150 quid for doing it. I think, well, every time I link to someone, that's worth, I'm doing air quotes here, that's worth 150 quid. And I kind of like that. I like being able to do that, but there's no mechanism for it. Anyway, we're waffling. The point.
No, you're waffling. I'm just waffling.
I suppose the thing was, so we had Bandcamp and SoundCloud as a contrast to what MySpace gave.
Yeah.
Flickr and to an extent Instagram or Picasa as a contrast to what MySpace gave in terms of photos, because again they weren't embeddable.
Well, I think Jerry Engstrom, the founder of Jaiku, he nailed it when he said that the social networks that work are the ones that work with social objects, because people don't just connect. I mean, this is the problem with MySpace, or yet another of the problems with MySpace, is it was just about collecting points. You didn't connect about anything; you just connected.
Yeah.
LinkedIn, to a certain extent, is the same thing. You just kind of, you know, can I add you to my professional network? So I don't even know what that is.
I can't be added. I'm not professional. I'm not part of your network. But other than that, yeah, sure.
Yeah, knock yourself out. But the thing that makes Flickr work is it's connecting about photographs.
Mm.
And it's here is an occasion for us to have a conversation about something. Mm. Bandcamp, same on the album level. SoundCloud, the same on the track level. You know, here is a thing. Let's talk about this. Is the subtext of shareable social media, social objects. And so to go, what works, is you go, well, is there a thing that I can take and share and have a conversation about? Mm. And I think that's the kind of the fundamental process of it. And the Facebook problem is that you can share it, but you can't take it.
Yeah.
And you can share it within these parameters so that it stays in the ecosystem of Facebook, which is basically a walled garden. And I'm locked out of it because I've decided not to engage with Facebook. So I mean, I can't look at your Facebook page.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, the idea that everybody in the world is on Facebook is a nonsense.
Yeah. There is the invitation that MySpace or Facebook gives us to put all of our stuff on there and to have it as this kind of one simple home, is problematic for a number of reasons. One, obviously, what happens when you want to pull out? You're left with an abandoned set of data.
Because it's not yours.
Because they've got it. And they won't even delete it.
You can download. Like, when I left Facebook, they said, you know, here is how, because we've had so many complaints about this, we'll reluctantly let you download your stuff. But we're still going to have it.
Yeah. And if you upload a load of video, that's quite a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
It's quite a especially if you've done it through an app where you've been filming it direct onto the site. So I suppose Vimeo is the next one. So we've done music, we've got Bandcamp, SoundCloud, photos.
Vimeo, YouTube, I don't have a problem with YouTube particularly. And in fact, there was, from a musician's point of view, there was an interesting comment going around the internet, in one of my mailing lists that I read, somebody said, why can't we just have a buy button next to every YouTube music clip? Because people who know how to do this, and not everybody, but people are finding ways to scrape MP3s off YouTube clips. They said, why are we putting up barriers in their way? Why don't we just put a buy button next to them? Google can take a cut and all the rest of it, and let's just all sign an agreement. And I thought that was kind of an interesting conversation to have.
Well, there are iTunes buttons now. So Google have done a deal with iTunes, and if the metadata matches, it creates an automatic...
Yeah, but not. But this thing, I mean, there's 15 to 20 million songs on iTunes... Yeah. So, like, about a tenth of the number of songs that are on YouTube.
Well, and dodgy metadata breaks it. And it's... Because YouTube got a whole bunch of things right. One of them was the fact that this idea that if someone has uploaded a song outside of the licensing terms of that bit of music, that the person who owns the license, when they find it, has two choices. Rather than just clicking it and saying, take it down... They can say, actually, I'll have the ad revenue of this because it's mine, which is about 70% right. Two things I got wrong, one of which is it's not transparent, so I don't get told that that's what's happened. I just suddenly start seeing ads appear on my song, if I'm the one who's uploaded it. Two, there's no conversation about it, that if they decide to take it down, I don't get to go to them and say, hold on, what's the problem? I'm happy for you to make money off this. That's why I put it here. And thirdly, you need to have a specific kind of account to be able to do it. So there's a kind of a sort of a slightly Big Brother-y clandestine thing to it. But they've tried to solve a problem. And the reason they've tried to solve a problem is the problem for them is we don't want to deal with takedown notices. It's not we want to help musicians.
Yeah, and they get thousands and thousands. I don't know if you've seen the data on this.
But it's ridiculous.
It's insane. And so they've had to come up with a mechanism of doing it. Vimeo don't have quite the same problem because what's really interesting about Vimeo, because Vimeo could be just like YouTube. There's nothing in the architecture of Vimeo that prevents that. But there is something in the culture of Vimeo that people use it in a particular way. It's a lot of independent filmmakers. It's a lot of people who are uploading things that they've made. Mm. And the way that the community works, I mean, you look at the comments on YouTube and then you go and compare that to the comments in Vimeo. Yeah. It's an entirely different cultural environment. Yeah. And yet, from a technological point of view, there is no difference between those two things. So there is that kind of other dimension to it, which is this is how we behave here. And setting those social norms is kind of interesting.
Well, I remember four years ago, I was on a network called Seismic, which is now, Seismic, the name, is now used for a number of social network aggregation things. But at the time, it wasn't anything of the sort. It was a video conversation platform. But actually, not long after Seismic started, YouTube introduced the potential. We're just pouring another glass of wine here because we're going on and on and on. YouTube introduced the mechanics to do exactly the same thing on YouTube. Right. That you could answer videos all of a sudden. You could actually provide something as a response to something else. So the possibility of having a threaded conversation was all of a sudden there on YouTube. And particularly if you were going to go and embed them elsewhere, then you could actually do it in a far more granular way. There was just no community of that at all. And people were using the video response thing, post a response to this on YouTube, as a way of spamming the famous version of a song that they'd done a crap cover version of.
Yeah. Well, the language, again, is what's important there, because on YouTube, they have channels. Like, you watch my channel.
Yeah.
Which is, again, it's a broadcast metaphor.
Mm.
So that kind of factors large in that. So people act like audiences rather than...
So the what have we got here? We've got four different types of media. We have audio, static image, video, and text.
Yeah.
And the last one we got to is text. And I think actually text is one of those ones that again, MySpace started off selling us a lie about, and it got better as people started to understand what the blog bit was for. But it was still, by and large, it was about cut and pasting your newsletter into it. Mm. And what we missed was the way that conversations work around music. And one of the interesting things for me was when I started thinking about why we read music magazines when we were younger. And I've never looked at the cover of a music magazine and gone, oh, brilliant, I've never heard of that person, I'll buy that. The music magazines weren't about discovery. Mm. The conversations about music weren't largely in that sense, the sort of written conversation around music wasn't about discovery, it was about context. It was about learning more about people that we already knew about in order to feel more connected to music that we already listened to.
Mm.
And that gave us the impetus to go and listen to new things.
That wasn't my experience, though. I mean, as somebody who lived 12,000 miles away and buying British music magazines 3 months late, finding out who these bands were, never having heard of them, never having encountered them on the radio, because there wasn't... we had British music on the radio, but it was chart British music. Echo and the Bunnymen were never played on commercial radio in New Zealand. And so I found out about Echo and the Bunnymen because they were on the front cover of the NME. And so I'd buy it, and I'd go, who are these people? What do they sound like? How do I... And there was no way of doing that. But so there are differences in that.
Okay, that's interesting. Because what I found was that I would discover new bands because of, in the same way, because of a trusted brand, it's just the percentages were different. Mm. I would normally buy the copy of the magazine because I knew who was on the cover, but then because I trusted the magazine, I would discover new things within it. So If somebody that I liked was on the cover, if it was the Pixies or the Throwing Muses or something were on there, then I might buy it. But then I'd open it and go, "Oh, who's this? Who's Jane's Addiction? Let me find out about them," and go and do some discovery that way. But actually, the main my main mechanism.
I like that our examples age us exactly.
God, yeah. That we are, yes.
I'm 5 years older.
Children,
than you.
Yeah, children of the 80s. But me, late 80s. You young, you early 80s. But my main mechanism for hearing new music was the radio. Was John Peel,
right?
And so that I discovered.
So we had Barry Jenkin, who was kind of the poor man's John Peel.
Right. Okay. Did you get Peel as well? Did you get World Service?
We got a little bit later on, but we got sent cassettes from friends of friends, and so we knew about Peel. But only because we knew about Dr. Rock, who was Barry Jenkin.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, because Peel, I say quite often, he saved my life, but it certainly changed it. Growing up in Berwick-on-Tweed, where I was physically remote, but not New Zealand remote. So I was remote in the sense that in order to go to a gig, I had to go 60 miles to Newcastle and go to the Riverside.
Yeah.
So I hadn't been to a arena or stadium gig until I was well into my 20s. The biggest gig I'd been to, I think, was the Alarm at Newcastle City Hall. But anyway, the point being about that I discovered music by hearing music, but I heard music because of curation. So that it's somebody else who I trusted said, "Here, listen to this." But most of the written stuff that I was reading about music was about it being interesting, not about someone telling me it was good. And so I would there was still a trust element to it, in that it was either. Whether I was in my NME phase or my Kerrang phase or whatever, that I trusted the brand identity of the magazine, but actually that what I was discovering was that music was interesting, not that it was good.
And that sometimes now you've got the opportunity to discover that sometimes musicians are interesting, because the written word is now predominantly blogging.
Well, that's which is where I was heading. So thank you.
Yeah, I was trying to speed you up. You spread me up.
So the point being that actually writing about music and having an outlet for that isn't just. This isn't a newsletter. That isn't, because the problem with this is herein we get into the problem of email and the problem of information overload, which is that when you keep if you were to write emails to, I've got a friend of mine who started to actually send out his blog via email once a week as a kind of aggregated feed, and it's been interesting to know how effective it is for him, but because I just see it and delete it immediately because. Mm. I don't need to see a blog in that format. I don't want that kind of information in that way. And for the most part, email isn't a good format for that at all.
But yeah. See, I've just come to the opposite conclusion because I've just been going through my email because I had hundreds and hundreds of filters on my emails. So if it has these words, delete it. And actually, it started to cause some problems because there were some overlaps and clashes and so on. So I deleted all my filters and I've started again. And one of the things that I'm doing is all of the email lists that I'm subscribed to deliberately. I mean, I'm unsubscribing from lots of stuff that I've been added to, but the ones that I've deliberately chosen to subscribe to, I've got them auto reverting into a folder, and I'm approaching that the same way I would read an RSS reader. Mm. So these are my feeds in my email inbox rather than my feeds in my RSS reader. And actually, at that point, there becomes no distinction between them. And the flip side of that is I found out that actually quite a lot of people get New Music Strategies posts and my personal blog posts via email. They subscribe through FeedBurner to an email version of the website, right? So there are different ways of kind of getting that information. But that's the thing. I mean, it is just text and you can send it in any sorts of different ways.
Yeah, that's fascinating to know. That's great because I guess the thing there then is back to the conduit point, because I always like finding out that people are kind of using things in a way that I don't.
I think text is particularly malleable in that way.
Well, text is massive, but partly because text is searchable in a way that nothing else is.
Yeah.
So it's possible to be specific with text in a way that you can't be with anything else.
Right, because we had a conversation last week about the idea of, wouldn't it be great to have an audio version of Twitter?
Mm.
That you could have this kind of, and it fed in the same way. And you go, well, isn't that audio boo, or isn't that this, that, kind of thing? No, I mean, literally, you can follow all these people and there would be a stream, but it would be in your headphones rather than on your screen. So you could walk along listening to it and then you could press the respond button and just say your 140 characters or whatever it is. But the problem with that is, I mean, I love the idea still, but and incredibly impractical. But the problem with it is, how do you make it searchable?
Yeah, and on a minute level, because you can search on Twitter, you can search for partial words. You don't even it doesn't have to be a whole word. You can search for part of a word. Obviously, whoever someone's taxi for Dubber as words. Stop talking. I think the text is the most malleable element of the internet.
Well, it's the hashtag really that makes it sing on Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely. And we don't mind background noise. We're fine with that.
Yeah,
we did the video outside, didn't we? But the point about subscribe by email is really interesting because I would never do that, and yet I find that making that possible is a really good thing. That actually having that as an option. Because do Bandcamp still have RSS feeds for albums?
Yep.
That's another really interesting one that I've never actually explored as a thing to kind of...
But that's the thing. RSS is one of these technologies that people either know what to do with or they don't. And if they don't, it doesn't matter. They can just ignore it. And if they do, they can do interesting stuff with it. And it does open up possibilities. But I like that kind of... the kit set nature of the web, that you can just take bits and make things out of them.
And that is the key. That's the point I was going to make. That's why I suggested this as a topic, is that actually what we're trying to look for is one size fits all, and actually we want is 200 sizes fits 200. That we want, that there are a number of services that do these things well. It's always worth considering what the person's business is or the platform's business is. And if their business is scraping and selling data, then you need to be aware of the fact that that's why you're uploading things. Mm. That's why they're letting you do it. It's not because they want to help you. It's because they want to sell you, sell access to you, and sell information that they glean from the things you upload to someone else who's willing to pay for it in order to then try and sell you other things or for considerably more nefarious needs.
Yeah.
So having a self-hosted website, your point earlier on, I think for me that's non-negotiable. We might end up redoing this completely. For me that's non-negotiable. I think that you need your own space, but making everything shareable allows other people to do the work for you. That Facebook, the like has become, it gets the more of them that happen, the less it's worth. The easier it is, the less it's worth. Mm. The crazy things about the way that sharing on the web works is that everybody tries to make it easier, but every time it's easier, it means less. Because all of a sudden, you need another order of, another a decimal point of usage to make it worth anything.
Yeah,
it's all right, Bobby. You can close the door. It's okay. So you need another 10,000 likes on Facebook for it to mean anything. And if you don't have them, there's no connection. Distribute your stuff. Stick it on conduits, not destinations. Mm. Copy it into the destinations. Facebook does fine with Flickr embeds and YouTube embeds, just as well as it does with stuff that's put in there, that's copied onto there.
Yeah.
Upload it to both if you want. And if you like having all of your Facebook pictures viewable on Facebook, fine. But don't leave it just there. Don't... Because that first question, what's the new MySpace? The new MySpace is the internet. Mm. The new MySpace is doing the internet well, and it's putting things in places where people who are into photos can find out what you do because you put up nice photos. People who are into reading about musicians will get interested in you because you're interesting, not because you tell them how good you are. I mean, this is the point we've been making all along, but that's the writing about music is not... You can't describe music. Everybody's a genius until you've heard them. So write interestingly about music so that people go, oh, maybe this person's worth listening to. Put your music in places where the people who love it can go, that's great, I need to play it to that person. And they don't have to kind of say, go to his MySpace page and listen to the fourth tune, because it won't happen.
Well, this brings us full circle back to the conversation about who are you doing this for? Are you trying to get new audiences, or are you trying to sort of entertain the audiences that you have? But the thing is, if you super serve your kind of regular punters... Mm-hmm. They're your best advertising. They're the ones who can take the stuff and share it and go, you have to hear this, this is amazing. Let me play it to you. Mm. Or let me show it to you, or let me read this piece of writing about it. And so that ability for things to be modular and to be shareable and to be, starters for conversation. That's what makes this work. And that's why I think this kind of idea of centralization and, you know, walled gardens, it kind of breaks that. Because even though you can share things within Facebook, it's not for sharing. It's for generating stuff that can be mined for later sale. And that kind of, for me, it really problematizes that.